And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Larenas.
Okay. All right, this is Phil Larenas, and I, what's left of him, I'm regretting I was ever born, and just loving every moment of not being able to see things, find things, etc. If this episode doesn't sound very good, keep it to yourself. All right. Over in Detroit, Michigan, Motown... It's the Motor City Madman, Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
Hey, Phil. I'm doing much better than you, it sounds like.
So you are looking forward to a big trip to Chi-Town this week.
I'm going to Schaumburg, Illinois, the bustling suburb of Chicago, Illinois. So
What will you do for fun during the weekend there?
Well, it's going to be nothing but fun. What won't I do for fun is the big question. It's the fan-run X-Files convention, the second annual, the first annual being apparently quite the success.
We got live reports from the floor on this very podcast last year.
That's right. Everybody seemed to enjoy it immensely, so I'm there this year with the other fellow lone gunman. Frank Spotnitz will be there. Plethora of... authors, writers, actors, performers, everybody related to the X-Files. I've been invited to see the historical artifacts of the X-Files. Nothing makes you feel older than all the props from the show you were in are now historical artifacts. So,
oh, you yourself are a historical artifact.
Yeah, sad but true.
And yet you're so naturalistic. I just threw that in as a reference, as a nod of the cap, as a wink of the eye to John Lawler, who does our theme songs, whose back has been acting up, and it's an inside joke.
I see. Do I get it as well? I'm not sure I do.
I don't know. Yeah, it's fine.
Good on the inside jokes.
Exactly. No better start to a show. But you're going to be in and around Chicago. Like, are you flying or are you driving to this thing?
I'm flying.
So yes. You fly to Chicago. So are you going to take in any of the sights? I mean, you've never really spoken. No. Really? That's how we feel about Chicago, huh?
No, I love Chicago. I've been there many times. I've been to the famous Second City stage. I performed at Zany's Comedy Club there. And then the couple other places that had no longer exist. Chicago, I love. I go often, as often as I can. But this is, I hit the ground running. They've booked 72 hours of my time. Everything's carefully coordinated. And then back on a plane and back to Detroit with me. So...
Wow, they don't even let you sleep. It's just a sleep deprivation exercise.
Sleep deprivation exercise. Yes, everybody's getting a piece of the Haglund is what they're getting.
If what I hear is true, the interest with a buzz, and that buzz is all about your streaming comedy series.
Is that right? Are we a buzzin'? We are buzzin'.
How many episodes are there?
Presently, I get up at 3 a.m. We lay down about 3 or 4 episodes over a 3 to 4 hour stretch. And then the sun comes up and my studio doesn't look like space anymore. So we have about 7 to 9 episodes that you can see at episodes.gravityhole.com.
Episodes.gravityhole.com. Now, you've done 7 to 9, but you said that they're live, right? So when you say you get up and you do 3 to 4 in a stretch, those are all live streaming so people could watch the 3 to 4 back to back to back to back?
Well, what we've done is we've pre-recorded a handful so that we have go-tos when our streaming screws up. So you can watch those. Those will be our repeaters because those won't have any interaction as the live streaming will, because we're going to have a feed where trolls and everybody can just yell at us or do whatever, and we don't care. So that's going to be part of the comedy, and we haven't actually fully done a live stream one yet. We've done partial live streams, and we recorded what would have been live stream, but we turned the stream off and done it exactly as if, but without the stream on. That's all.
Episodes.gravityhole.com.
Yes.
For all your improv sci-fi comedy needs.
More inane, mindless, inane 20 minutes. It starts with a self-destruct sequence and it ends with our destruction over and over again.
That's so much like this podcast.
Yeah.
If only we thought to bank shows and if we stuck to an actual time limit,
right? Yeah, we have no ability to lengthen our show on Gravity Hole. It is nothing but a doom clock over our shoulder telling us that our own deaths are imminent.
Yeah.
Imminent over and over again. Imminent.
Inamint sounds delicious, though.
I'm in a mint. I'm in a mint chocolate outfit right now.
All right. Gravity Hole's the show. We look forward to hearing more. But now, of course, we got to go into a gravity hole that we like to call celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
Some interesting people to get to celebrate this week, I must say. I'm gonna start with a singer that I always enjoyed, especially when I was a kid. I think maybe I either first got to know him through maybe commercials, maybe his appearances on Saturday Night Live, always television appearances, not actual recordings, and certainly not the radio. But it was the Tin Pan Alley singer Leon Redbone.
Oh, yeah. Leon Redbone. He
died at 69. He also had what?
He did a couple commercials that I remember hearing that voice.
Yeah, they're unmistakable and quite catchy. But he was super cool. I mean, he was very popular across a variety of platforms, we would say now, but across a wide range of not only musical genres, but medium as well. He performed vaudeville and Tin Pan Alley songs. And as I mentioned, appeared many times on Saturday Night Live, Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Carson loved him. His act was unusual, but he developed a strong cult following. He was known for that Panama hat that he always wore, the dark sunglasses, the black tie, and, of course, just an inimitable voice.
Right.
Probably, I'm going to hazard a guess, made the most money in his career for singing the theme song to the hit TV sitcom Mr. Belvedere.
I bet that was a big payoff because those last a long time.
Yeah, and residuals back then and everything. He appeared in movies and TV shows. He voiced Leon the Snowman in the movie Elf. He released 16 albums during his career, and such big wigs that count themselves as influenced by him and fans of his work are Jack White and Bob Dylan.
Wow. I can see that for sure.
All right. I don't want this question to make you claustrophobic, Dan. But who was Klaus von Bülow?
Klaus von Bülow, I know only from seeing the movie where Jeremy Irons portrayed Klaus von Bülow. He was acquitted of a bunch of murders.
No, not a bunch. Wow, we that was quite a powerful performance Jeremy Irons gave. Apparently, yes. The movie that won an Oscar for Jeremy Irons for Best Actor, Reversal of Fortune.
Reversal of Fortune,
which focused on Klaus von Bülow's conviction and then acquittal once he was represented by Alan Dershowitz, and
right.
Von Bülow. Was a Danish British socialite, and I just realized that socialite has no gender connotation to it.
Ah.
I always thought of socialites as women, but men are socialites as well. So so I learned a little something in this trip to the Chilpak morgue. It was a 1980s court case that was sensational. I mean, you know, we had the tabloids were in full swing, and this was regular fodder for the
right.
tabloids. It had everything. I mean, it had money and sex and royalty and foreigners. And so he was accused, convicted, then acquitted of attempting to kill his American wife, Sonny von Bülow. She
right.
was a very wealthy heiress whose money fueled the couple's rather infamous spending sprees. And when she went into a brief coma in December 1979, and then an irreversible one a year later, in December 1980, von Bülow was accused of trying to kill her by injecting her with insulin to aggravate her low blood sugar. So the trial was in their adopted state of Rhode Island, a place you just visited for the first time. I'm sure they're still talking about it to this day, right? So he was sentenced to 30 years in prison, but he insisted on his innocence, was bailed out for $1 million, filed an appeal, and again, represented by Alan Dershowitz, and was found not guilty of all charges. In later years, in order to foster peace between his family and her family, between his child with Sonny von Bülow and his stepchildren, I understand that he gave up any claim to the to inheritance or to the estate at all.
Oh, okay.
So
I bet that worked.
I don't know. I really don't know. But Klaus von Bülow, a chapter comes to a close. But it is, you know, it's hard to imagine now because, again, I mean, it was the O.J. trial before the O.J. trial. I mean, I
right.
would say that that was the big trial of the century before that one. There's so many trials of the century each century. But
I know. No, you can't fit them all in the century that the trial was in. Somebody should have the trial for the next century.
Now, you know I do another podcast. I do a podcast about the Breakfast Club.
Yes.
Missed last month. Going to do one this month. And one of the people that I interview, really wonderful storyteller and performer and good friend, Adam Melema. And one of the shows that he does is he recites firsthand accounts of World War II from the men and women who were there and does his best not only to honor their stories by getting them word perfect, he goes and meets with the people and records them and performs them in order to honor them. But he also, as a performer, you know, really embodies the energy of these people. And we were talking apropos of something you and I have discussed from time to time in celebrity deaths and which rears its ugly head again right now, but how we are fast, we are at this point where we are rapidly losing all of the people who were firsthand witnesses to that era of history.
Right. Yes. War, well, that's a natural progression of attrition, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's something about World War II that is such a watershed, such a
yes.
such a precipice between, really, to me, it's the dividing line between modern culture and previous cultures.
Absolutely, because you had a baby boom directly after the war, which led to those generation starting the 60s counterculture revolution and successive generations, even why we now call millennials and Gen Z. It all started with baby boomers as a marketing idea.
I mean, so much of the modern economy is built after World War II, but often using assembly line methodologies that are implemented fully during World War II as part of the war effort. And then also, I think that there's such an effort to make sure that these men and women, but who served, when they come back home, that they are given an opportunity to fully participate in the American dream that they fought for.
Right, and the GI Bill, so they could go...
get a home.
That was the,
And
the community college thing and all of that.
But but also the idea of it's your patriotic duty, if you have a company, to employ these people, to give them good jobs when they come back.
Right.
And so what we see for the first time in really any country, anywhere, the emergence of a majority middle class.
Right. Through social engineering.
Yeah.
I mean, consciously built, like all the houses in the valley, right? All through the San Fernando Valley, the down payment for any one of those houses was $1,000, which is what you were given when you left the army. You were given, here's $1,000 in the GI Bill, which will pay for your education. So you could do a down payment on a three-bedroom house in the valley, go to one of the community colleges that just were built up almost every 10 miles back then, retrain yourself for some new job or job skill that you would like to have, and then lo and behold, you had a family, you had a house, and you had an education to a good job. I mean, it was crafted.
So the reason I bring this all up is because Levi Oakes, or Levy Oakes, Levi, I'm going to call him Levi Oakes, but 94 years of age, dies this week, and he was the last surviving member of the Mohawk tribe, based there in northern New York, who served as a code talker in World War II. He served in the Pacific during the war and was awarded a silver medal and a silver star for his heroism. Saw action in the Philippines and in New Guinea. For those who don't know, I mean, you know, we used Native Americans speaking their ancient dialects, indigenous dialects, to translate messages so that there was no chance of having the code broken, because you would literally need to have been raised in that to understand the,
exactly.
the language.
Yes. And they were wind talkers. Yeah. There's a terrible Nick Cage movie that was supposed to be about that.
I think John Woo directed that, didn't he?
Ooh, he might have, which...
John Woo, who is on June 18th appearing at the Vista Theater, where Lily Holloman and Phil Larenas got married, showing The Killer in a 30th anniversary 35 millimeter screening. So the kid's going to be there. I'd been thinking about The Killer a lot lately, but that has nothing to do with Levi Oakes, who was not a killer. He was a hero, and he, you think, okay, so he was working the phones, he was translating stuff and everything. Turns out this guy was one of the guys responsible for actually laying the lines on enemy battlefields.
What?
Yeah.
Like putting down cable.
Yeah, exactly.
Like installing, like...
Yeah. Field lines.
High-speed internet.
Field lines,
while getting shot at.
So that they could give their reports,
Wow.
Anyway, after his service, he worked in the iron industry in Buffalo, New York. Yeah. But another one of these, you know, it's safe to say, you know, we will not see his like again. And, you know, the stories of what he witnessed. I mean, it's true because also with World War II, no war would ever be fought that way again, right?
Right. Yeah, for sure.
The immediacy of these things.
Well, and a clear definition of enemy combatant and soldier. You know, you had a very evil political structure. It was easy to know the bad guy, the good guy. It was so clear. No other war since then. I was either a quagmire or you didn't know what you were fighting for. No front lines identified. It was the last war to do that.
On this Breakfast Club podcast that Adam appears, I actually, it kind of all of this dovetails. Adam just came back from a far out trip to the Far East, including Tokyo. And so I used it as a reason to play a clip of when the Japanese trade minister Matsuoka appeared in, I think, 1935 at the Breakfast Club. And this man was an infamous diplomat. I don't want to go down this rabbit hole too far, but among other things, he was the diplomat to the League of Nations who basically blew the whole thing up in the 1930s. You know, he represented this real nationalist fervor in Japan. He advocated the adoption of a Japanese National Socialist Party. And here he is at the Breakfast Club, a club of friendship, talking about how friendly the trade relations are between America and Japan. And, you know, within 5 years, he would be one of the leading political advocates to declare war on America and to ally with the Germans to offset the U.S. growing economic dominance. So it's chilling. Hearing his speech is quite chilling. Anyway, before we let go of Mr. Oakes, on his experience in the war, this is what he wrote. I wanted to look this up because you seemed intrigued by this. He said, "We laid out the field wires out in the jungles and all of that stuff. It's exciting, but it's not too good of a job. It's dangerous over there. They were supposed to put me on the radio, but they put me on the field wire communications and all that stuff. There's only one or two persons I'd talk to when I was there in Mohawk. It was a secret code. We'd talk our own language in Mohawk with the other person, but they'd give us a paper to read on it, and you got to translate it exactly." So,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Hey,
exciting.
This kind of brings to mind something that I wanted to ask you about, a news question as we close up the Chilpack morgue. This news story about the CBC revealing that the Canadian government, since the 1980s, has been guilty of the systematic genocide of Indigenous women.
Oh, no, I missed this story.
Oh, my God. This has been big news this weekend. Yeah, thousands of Indigenous women since 1980 systematically removed, let's say, killed, gone missing, coordinated efforts by the Canadian government.
Okay. I now need to read up on this because this has completely gone over my head. How are they saying it's coordinated by the Canadian government? Had trouble.
The official announcement was happening today. You know, I always get my news a little bit in advance. CBC checks in with me on these things just to give me a heads up.
Wow.
Because, you know, Canadian historical artifact Dean Haglund is a regular fixture on Chilpack Hollywood Hour. So
yes. They
want us to have a heads up. Because they know you're going to be inundated with questions about this as a duly designated representative of all things Canadian.
Right. Holy smoke. So now this sounds way more sinister than just government ineptitude, which was often the case with Inuit and up in Nunavut. A lot of those communities that suffered a lot of problems were not necessarily systematically being eradicated, but they were being mismanaged to the point of it, of their detriment. Is this that kind of story, or is it more sinister?
I don't know. I think you're going to need to look this up. I mean, maybe it is such a thing as the incompetence is deemed to have been willful and coordinated incompetence. You know, I mean, it almost seems like, you know, there you're talking about kind of similar to behavior that slumlords have been found guilty of. And this kind of institutionalized racism that was allowed to exist, you know, in housing for so long. So anyway, so why don't you research this and file us a full report?
Very good. It's on my list.
I also thought about you when I saw the mass shooting, our most recent mass shooting. At least 12 dead, as I know of, because you're a big fan of the mass shootings.
Okay, let's dial that down.
that is aggregator clickbait content right there. Dean Haglund from the X-Files. I'm a fan. He's a fan of mass shootings.
Phil Lernes.
No, I thought about you because Virginia Beach, Virginia, isn't that where you shot Atlantis Down?
That is correct, yes. Spent many a day in Virginia Beach, a lovely community right there on the beach. And I am shocked. I am shocked that that kind of rage could build up on such a peaceful, soothing, the waves coming in from the Atlantic, everything you would think would assuage the nerves.
That's why every... rehab commercial
clinic
shows ocean waves, but new horizons,
that's right.
You know, in violence prevention, right, one of the things that you'll hear, especially in abusive relationships, is he drinks, right? And he's lovely, and then when he drinks he gets abusive and stuff. As if that's somehow an excuse, as opposed to just another symptom of underlying feelings of powerlessness.
Right.
But also what it ignores is that alcohol is a depressant, right? So for people to lash out and get violent, most people, when they drink, actually become maybe loud, maybe, you know, a little bit insufferable, but for the most part, really lovely, very kind and lovely. And eager to please, all the things that you repress as you relax. To get physically abusive, to have that kind of rage pour out while on a physical relaxant shows just how deep in those people the wells of powerlessness run. Right.
Right.
So. Getting back to this idea of on a beach community, you don't think that this could ever happen. But God damn it, in modern life or postmodern life, whatever the hell we're calling it now, there is no safe haven, and reservoirs of powerlessness run deep beneath the surface of this entire culture.
Yeah. Now how, and I was thinking about this because somebody I was talking about this idea of powerlessness. And they go, well, how do you empower entire populations? And I couldn't, off the top of my head, have the succinct answer to that. But you empower yourself, and then theoretically that ripples out.
We empower through education, through parenting, through the stories that we tell about... healthier relationships to our own impulses and emotions, right?
Right.
That's how we do it. Is it possible to do it? Absolutely. And then the work begins, once we get there, because then we start to build healthy relationships to other people. But it starts with the healthy relationship to the things we ourselves are feeling. And let's face it, that has never been... a chief commodity of industrialized and the industrialized North, but especially capitalist America.
Right. Yeah.
Our primary, again, post-World War II, anyway, these are not the, the fundamental driving forces, the health of our population. But maybe that, but that conversation, I think, is shifting, right?
Right.
Especially once healthcare threatens to bankrupt the entire country, suddenly the health of the population does matter, and damn it, things like PTSD and how much money those lawsuits are costing suddenly gets mental health care to be something that people talk about, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Why is my eye surgery covered by insurance? Because I can't work and therefore can't be a taxpayer if I can't see to a basic functional level.
Right.
Correcting my vision so that I don't need glasses, well, that's not covered. Because
you can see,
right, with help that I will pay for and then put that money back into the economy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But if you are blind,
yeah,
so that you're not functioning,
yeah,
they'll pay for that.
Interesting. Yeah. So, hey, you know, apropos of all this, we made a reference, a joking reference, to the Bowling Green massacre when we were remembering Tim Conway, when we were celebrating him. And we got an email about that.
Hi,
Phil and Dean.
Hey, that's us.
Hope you've been enjoying this Memorial Day weekend. Sorry your eyes are giving you such trouble these days, Phil. Wishing you a successful surgery and speedy recovery. In last week's episode, you mentioned that the late Tim Conway attended Bowling Green State University, where he did not witness the Bowling Green Massacre, since the only place said massacre actually took place was in presidential advisor Kellyanne Conway's mind. As an aside, I assume and hope that the two Conways in question were in no way related.
Hey, well done.
But yeah. I wanted to pick a very small nit about this. Even if the Bowling Green Massacre had been more than a figment of Ms. Conway's fevered imagination, young Tim could not have witnessed the Bowling Green Massacre there. Kellyanne said the event had occurred in Bowling Green, Kentucky, which is home to the National Corvette Museum, Cheney's Dairy Barn, and the Bowling Green Hot Rods baseball team. But Bowling Green, Kentucky is not home to Bowling Green State University, which is located in Bowling Green, Ohio, just south of Toledo, and not more than a couple hours' drive from Dean's new home.
Exactly. I drove actually through Bowling Green recently.
Having,
for some reason.
Having visited Bowling Green State University several times recently, I can say that the campus is remarkably flat. I imagine folks from the old country setting up their lawn bowling greens with very little leveling needed to create a perfect surface for play. Best regards, Bob. That comes to us from Bob Petrulis. So, if you want to keep your fictional massacres straight, the Bowling Green Massacre was to have taken place in Bowling Green, Kentucky, not in Bowling Green State University in Ohio.
Got it.
Of course, commingled them because of the actual Kent State University massacre in Ohio.
Right. I got it. So now that that's cleared up, I think it's funny, Kellyanne Conway and Tim Conway being related. I think that's hilarious.
Well, they certainly are now.
Yeah, right? Hilarious. Well, that was a good one.
Yeah.
We are now school. Yep.
It was a good one. So let's talk about some movies, Dean Haglund.
Yeah. I want to talk about some movies.
What movies do you want to talk about?
I don't know. I got Doberman.
I've got a lot. So I've got several topics here I want to discuss, and I don't know exactly how to get into it, but it's more or less, let's just call this the state of the movie business, colon, where the hell do we go from here?
Very good.
Because as we've talked about on and off, a lot of really good movies are being made.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of really talented people. And
yeah.
there is a hunger to see things.
Okay.
So many fortunes are being made off the hunger to see good stories being told.
Right.
And those fortunes are not going to the people telling the stories, but to the people who set up the platforms.
Sure.
And the CEOs of these megalithic corporations. I mean, it was interesting seeing the opening of the Star Wars land at Disney.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they're on stage with George Lucas and Mark Hamill and Harrison Ford and Bob Iger, the CEO of Disney. And, of course, the richest of all of them is the youngest of all of them. Bob Iger, right?
Right.
Who has yeah. never created a franchise.
No.
He's a CEO. He's probably got an MBA and maybe a legal degree. And,
sure.
And he is taking up a lot of the oxygen in the room, right? The
But he is steering a large ship.
Okay, I understand that. I understand that. Yeah. As are his counterparts. And most of these large ships end up losing a lot of money, and so we have to replace them, but not before we give you billions of dollars in your severance package. And this is the nature of international corporate conglomerates right now.
Right.
So I'm running the risk of advocating socialism in this. So
okay.
hold my feet to the fire.
Wow.
You know, tell me love it or leave it. it's America. But I do want to look through the prism of the film business and what's good if we love movies. So
yeah.
if we want what's good for the movies, then regardless of whether I sound like I'm advocating socialism and that is of an offense to some of our listeners, please realize that I'm talking about it again through this idea of historically what helped make movies great. And what allowed them to capture the imagination of populations the world over. Of course, one of those things was that they were affordable. Even during
right.
the darkest economic times, people could
right.
afford to go to the movies. And that's certainly not true. People who work for a living, maybe multiple jobs even, it's so expensive to go to the movies.
Yes.
And in order to stay au courant, you've got to also have your subscriptions to your Netflixes, your HBOs, your cables, so much more. There's so much money being spent on entertainment dollar just to stay current.
Right.
And,
yes.
And
what everybody's talking about.
To pay for them, you don't have time to watch any of them.
well, you know, that is very true. I hadn't thought that through. But now realize, okay, there's more and more content.
And there's more and more content all
content.
The time. Because
yeah.
we need to keep feeding this, because to keep our internet channel alive, to keep our platform alive, we need to keep pumping pipeline of content in so that when you go, you always see new titles that you'll never watch.
Right, because this is, you know, we are now 120 years past the Industrial Revolution and modernism. And in modernity, it is always the new that is celebrated. So we are now in a continual addition to newness.
But I would say that technologically, for the first time, we also have access to everything that has come before.
Right.
So the libraries are enormous.
Right.
The level of content is enormous. All right. So the companies that control them have become enormous integrated structures. All right.
Yes.
So let's bring it back down to the micro. To discuss a couple of these movies, and then maybe we can expand out to the macro, because we're always talking about, well, where do we go from here? What is the answer, right? Because because people want to make movies, people want to see movies. There's no question about that. And
right.
as I point out, one of my favorite figures ever is, you know, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars some of these movies cost, billions of dollars some of these movies made, and yet the profit margin on motion pictures is no different today than it was 40 years ago.
Right. Right.
The percentages don't change. Just the number of players that get to sit at the table and the amount that some of those players get. But it's fewer players now that get anything, but they get more. But it's the same percentage of players that get anything because there's fewer players altogether. Okay? So it's okay. So it's fascinating. But we have a movie. You and I have just ranted and raved about the lack of comedies in general. Good right. comedies in particular, but comedies in general. If people are not in the habit of making comedies, it's very hard to make good ones. And,
right.
And part of it is a self-fulfilling prophecy because, you know, it started with the explosion of international markets at the box office uh-huh. and American studios saying, well, let's not make comedies because comedy doesn't export.
Yeah, it's hard to translate.
They think.
Right.
And so... So they stopped making them. And that meant we want things that are going to make a lot of money overseas. So what does translate? And that's when you saw budgets start to really expand. And the dollars going towards stars who played overseas expanding. And
right.
But comedies getting, yeah. getting squeezed out. There is a movie out 2 weeks now. It was released as kind of counter-programming on Memorial Day weekend called Booksmart.
Yeah.
Directed by the actress Olivia Wilde, making a terrific directorial debut. Written by a handful of very talented ladies. Produced mm-hmm. by Will Ferrell and Adam McKay through wow. their Gloria Sanchez label. A couple years back, they started, a la Gary Sanchez, which is their production shingle, they set up a Gloria Sanchez label for female-driven movies that they wanted to produce. And this is one of the results of that. Now, this film gets released in the shadow of the news that Will Ferrell and Adam McKay are shuttering their production partnership. It's coming to an end. Not through acrimony or animosity. They love each other. They love working together. But the movies that Adam McKay himself wants to make are not the kind of movies that Will Ferrell himself wants to make. And... so they will continue to partner together on the movies that they have in development to produce, but they've grown differently. Their interests are different, and so one of the most successful producers of comedies will be shutting up shop very soon, and Booksmart is one of the best that they've produced. I'm not making this review up, and I'm probably paraphrasing, but it's so accurate that I want to share it with you. It is, what was the Jonah Hill, Michael Cera? Superbad. Remember Superbad? What a big hit that was, which really launched Jonah Hill and Michael Cera as viable movie actors.
Absolutely. Big and, jokes in that, yeah.
And Booksmart has been called by at least one critic Superbad with girls, only funnier and better. And that is everything that reviewer said is 100% accurate.
Wow!
And when I say Superbad, I mean beat by bit. It's a remake of Superbad. Caitlin Dever. Damn if she doesn't even, who I've always loved ever since she was a regular on Justified, she resembles Michael Cera. The other young lady lead, whose name I'm unfortunately I did not write down and I can't look it up because I can't see the internet, but she is more Jonah Hill than Jonah Hill in terms of comedic timing. And,
wow.
So it really is a female take on this. And why not? That's
why
cool.
Not?
That's what comedy does. It takes something you know and bends it, puts it on its side, puts a new perspective on it. And if it's something that was already funny, putting a new perspective on it might just make it even more funny.
Wow. It's true. And we are, you know, as a culture evolves, what resonates, what makes us laugh changes over time. And for, you know, I am happy to see that the old Jerry Lewis slide that women aren't funny is long gone. And so why not go back and look at all these comedies and see it from a female perspective?
Now, so that's all great, right?
Right.
It's dying a horrible death at the box office.
Why
no
is that?
One will go to see this. The young girls that it was targeted at have gone. but it hasn't broken out. And the blame is being placed at, one, the death of MoviePass, and two, Netflix. I think you've got a bigger problem if you think you can blame it on one or two external factors, right? Like,
right.
How is it MoviePass's, the failure of MoviePass's fault that no one can afford to go see this movie when you as an industry didn't support MoviePass in the first place?
Right.
Right?
Yeah, and that seems impossible for that to have that kind of effect on a movie.
And if Netflix was the thing that you all got into bed with and you created, then, you know, again, I don't know how it can be the problem.
Right.
Netflix said, hey, there's room. You know, it's been a slowly evolving behemoth. And
right.
For 20 years, they have smartly carved out a niche and found new things that they could do and have evolved that way.
Yeah.
Clearly, as we say, there's an appetite to see movies, and there's got to be an appetite for comedy and for a good comedy. So, you know, but this is what I keep saying. Business-wise, we have to be as smart as we are creative.
Well, and here in my thinking is there's got to be a shift away from that bizarre 18 to 49 demographic, because now there's several generations that have changed the way they consume entertainment, and it no longer involves getting out of the house, going to your local cinema, sitting down with a bunch of strangers in a room watching a movie. That you have you, not you personally, but they have crafted a way to consume entertainment differently, and now are they reaping the misdirected sunshine that doesn't go on that wheat field anymore?
You know, a year ago, Eighth Grade and other independent films did very, very well because MoviePass existed and it helped underwrite these movies. And so instead of replacing it, instead of finding a methodology, you know, instead of going, oh my God, people really love going to the movies. How can we make that possible in a way that makes money? There's been no change in the movie business. They responded to that information by changing not at all what they do. you know, and Netflix has actually been, in its own way, I would argue, supporting the idea of theatrical, because, you know, they want awards, right? So they have to release their movies theatrically. I saw two of the movies that they've released theatrically this fall in recent days. I saw The Highwaymen, which came out in March in theaters.
Yeah.
And this is legendary, this movie.
Right.
Because it's one of the longest developing projects in the history of Hollywood.
Really? I didn't realize.
In the early 2000s, this movie was supposed to be made with Paul Newman and Robert Redford playing the aging highwayman. And it would have been something. You can understand the vision there.
Yeah.
As opposed to what ended up getting made by Netflix, starring Kevin Costner and Woody Harrelson. Actors I enjoy. Actors who have their moments in it. But there's no vision to that idea. You go, okay, Kevin Costner, Woody Harrelson, but what's the movie? What's your point of view? And you get a director, John Lee Hancock, who is a perfectly serviceable journeyman. And the movie looks good, but it's not a movie. There's no point of view to it. This is a film that very well ought to have been equal to Bonnie and Clyde.
Right. Yeah, it should have been.
And could have been. And could have been. And right now, in an era where we are inundated with gun violence, the way of the gun is what we are all wrestling with. How could this movie not be relevant? And it's not.
Yeah.
It's a time filler. And part of it is, you know, there was no point of view. And Netflix is not in the business of, they're not a studio. They're not like a studio. There's an idea of looking at them in the huge amount, expanse of land and the production facilities they've built. I mean, they've taken over so much of Hollywood physically, geographically. And there's an idea to see it as almost like the emergence of an old studio system. But the old studios were run by showmen.
Right. Still had an ear for that.
And they competed over top talent. Yeah. And they wanted that talent to be under contract to them.
Right.
And these people, therefore, could make a living, whether they were working on particular films or hits or not. You were drawn a weekly salary. And if you were popular, if you were good, you were going to be working all the time. And
if not, the studio sent you to classes. You were doing acting workshops, tap dancing classes, what have you. So you were always working.
But so they would look, you know, they would look for you to prove that you were the right person to, you know, tell a particular story that they wanted told. And then if they gave you your crack and you succeeded, then you got another crack at a bigger kind of film. Or maybe you got to say, what do you want to do next? But now it's all about packaging. They're not doing that. They're not driving the ship. They're not creative visionaries. They're really smart businessmen and women. And so this is how this package gets put together and gets approved by Netflix. But if you wanted to take a script, and I think there's script problems, but even this script, how do you turn that script into something more visionary? Well, find the director that has a visionary approach to it. Find a director who's already maybe been dealing with the themes expressed in this film, albeit on a smaller level, a director like Jeff Nichols, who did Take Shelter, one of my favorite films of the decade, who did Shotgun Stories, who did Midnight Special, who did Mud, who gives time and place their due as characters, who explores these cultural themes and give him this larger canvas, give him this more mainstream entertainment, and say, make us all proud. When Netflix signs up to do theatrical projects with artists like that, they've been going pretty well. Coen Brothers, Ballad of Buster Scruggs, and Roma. Now, what Netflix does not do, however, and they've got to get these films out in theaters in order to qualify for awards so that they can legitimately say, we make movies rather than we stream video-on-demand originals.
Right.
They don't report box office.
I know.
One of their movies opened this week, and it's a romantic comedy that's been getting 100% positive reviews, called Always Be My Maybe, starring Ali Wong and Randall Park, and written by them and produced by them, and directed by Nanochka Khan, who directs many episodes of Randall Park's series Fresh Off the Boat. But you won't find box office reporting for it. It opened this weekend in theaters, and like I said, to extraordinarily good reviews, which might get people into the theaters. But it is streaming also at the same time on Netflix. So clearly they don't want to reveal, their whole model is not letting anybody know how many people see what they do. They know what the profit margin is. They offer you money, and you either take it or leave it.
Right. It's a flat fee, and then they suffer the vagaries, as it were, on their side, mitigating risk, I guess. It sounds like that would be the only reason, right? I also appreciate that, because then now we are judging the movie on the value of its creator, on its ability to tell the story, as opposed to so much ever since, Jaws, Star Wars, 1977, that your advertising was how big the opening weekend was, how much money this thing made, or how much that budget was for that thing. And with Netflix withholding that information, I'm applauding it. I know maybe you're not, but I think it's a good thing to no longer use money as an indicator of value.
I am with you for all the reasons that you just said. And as an audience member, what appeals to you as opposed to what's everyone talking about?
Right.
Don't let the movie be reviewed for you by the money. Form a relationship to it. Absolutely. And that also gives an opportunity for films that maybe are not the kind of films that are going to play to a Thursday night preview audience to find legs, right? There's so much that goes into that that I agree with you.
Right.
On the other side, from the negotiating standpoint...
Exactly. Then you're screwed.
You're screwed. There's no such thing as profit participation if you're not allowed to know what the profits are, and you don't know how much to negotiate for the next time around.
Right. And if you get points, you don't even know if they're paying that outright. Points on numbers.
So
you don't know numbers.
But I keep coming back to this, where as long as there are rules in place that movies, to be considered movies, need to play theatrically, Netflix is going to keep expanding into this realm. And I keep coming back to my idea, which is their subscription model, which MoviePass proved people want, but the MoviePass financial model wasn't viable for MoviePass. But a subscription model, which is working great for AMC theaters, by the way, they're offering a subscription service. But
right.
With every one of these studios, these major players, launching their own streaming services, having their own libraries, the only thing, as we've talked about, that prevents them from owning enough theaters to be able to release exclusively to their theaters is antitrust laws.
Right.
And I have two thoughts about this. One, that doesn't prevent you from maybe entering into an exclusive agreement where here's what we'll do. We'll change our relationship in terms of ticket dollars. And if people subscribe at a certain level to our service, then they get a certain amount of admissions to your theaters to see
right.
our film.
Right.
And you get obviously still all the concessions, but the ticket pricing changes, therefore the percentages change, therefore
mm-hmm.
there's nothing, you could enter into these with these chains, like Regal is with Paramount, or Cinemark with Warner Brothers, or site specific theaters, or a certain number of screens. Nothing's preventing that. But the other thing is this idea of the antitrust laws.
Right.
I don't know. This is crazy. I'm not basing this on anything other than just talking out of my own ass. But for 13
okay.
years, that's why I've wanted to have a podcast.
But
Netflix has proven their subscription model twice now, right? Disc
right.
and streaming.
Yeah.
They are such a logical group to introduce a subscription service that includes theatrical if they had theaters, right?
Right.
And you want to see these movies on screen? You can. Maybe it's an either-or thing, or maybe it's included, or it's a tiered level, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But you can't get around the antitrust. One of the moves you might make in order to get the antitrust laws changed might be to bring in, I don't know, a former president, I don't know, Obama, to be Ooh. One of your top executives.
Say.
Which, of course, Netflix has done.
What?
Yeah. He and Michelle, that's their gig now. They are the top producers for Netflix. They're producing content for Netflix.
I didn't know that. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
So that then can be the lobby arm, as it were.
Yeah.
In reverse, trying to then change, take out antitrust, which, what year did that antitrust came in? That was like the 50s, 40s, or even earlier.
Yeah, I don't remember. I don't remember that.
And that was when the numbers were different, too. That was when you had, there was before television, so it was been the only source of entertainment, even though it was affordable, everybody was doing it.
Because this is where I'm getting to. I want, there's so many talented people working on stuff who have to work other jobs. I want people who are working on making content to be able to earn a living doing it, and I want the people who are working hard to earn livings so they can afford to be able to occasionally see a movie to be able to see a movie. And
right.
And the economic system that exists now in the movies kind of prevents both of those things. Fewer
right.
and fewer people can make a living doing this, and fewer people can go to the movies. And yet, more and more people want to be making movies, and clearly, as evidenced by the success of MoviePass and the success of Avengers and other things, people
right,
want
right.
to go to the goddamn movies. They want
right.
to have that communal experience. They want to have it on the big screen. A word about Always Be My Maybe, this romantic comedy.
Oh, yeah.
Which is very much, you know, a product of the success of Crazy Rich Asians, you know,
yeah.
last year, which was such a big hit. And,
big deal, yeah.
And this has gotten, like I said, 100% positive reviews. And I'm going to lay this down on the line. And one of the reasons it gets 100% positive reviews is because no one has the courage to give a bad review to an Asian-American romantic comedy at this point because you are anti-diversity.
Oh,
right. I am the wrong person to a degree to talk about these romantic comedies because, as you know, I've seen enough that work to probably prevent any future ones from working because the tropes are the tropes are the tropes.
Yeah.
But this is what I'm aware of. It is so powerful to see yourself represented on screen, and there are groups of people that have never been allowed to see themselves represented in stories and on screen. And
right.
on that level, this is hugely successful. It is a step up, quality-wise, absolutely, from Crazy Rich Asians, in that
right.
it is a step towards truth, towards real life, and therefore more meaningful. The performers are delightful. I don't think it's a good movie. But as I always used to say, apropos of the emerging Asian-American independent film movement, you have to grade on a different scale because people need to be able to learn how to do this.
Right.
And,
yes.
And we're at that point as an industry where I don't mean where Asian filmmakers need to learn how to do this, where when it comes to comedies and romantic comedies, we're back almost to the point where everybody needs to learn how to do this again.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And that's the other reason I think the critics want to bend over backwards to support it. And this one I'm on, you know, I understand as well, which is we want this to be successful so that we can have more.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Where are you going to learn the skills unless you are doing it?
And
that's
and
stand up
and critics understanding the power of their aggregated voice. If we all throw in behind this film, then we might get more, and as we get more, they might get better. And
right.
also it will provide much needed balance from the kind of movies that are being made.
Right. Fascinating.
And will lead to more people getting work. Right? People
yeah.
who are comedically gifted getting work. I will say that everything seems to be coming back to John Wick Chapter 3, though, because the funniest stuff in Always Be My Maybe involves in some way Keanu Reeves, who plays himself. And as I understand it, was given free rein to improvise almost everything he does in the movie.
Oh, wow.
And,
oh, okay.
and he's hilarious. And I don't think I've ever seen a movie where he actually gets to speak this much. He's only in a few scenes, and he says many more lines of dialogue than he says in the entire John Wick 3. but the other movie where it keeps coming up, John Wick, is Ian McShane, who, of course, is a key co-star in the John Wick movies,
yeah.
is back in his iconic role as Al Swearengen, the saloon proprietor in Deadwood, because the Deadwood movie premiered
yeah.
on May 31st.
Now, you saw this?
Oh, of course. I watched it the very day. a deadhead as I am of the
oh.
old HBO show Deadwood. If you have not seen the Deadwood TV series. Don't watch the movie.
Oh.
Yeah. No.
Okay.
They do enough to let you know some of the beats so that you can get it. But,
right.
But no, this is a movie for those people who liked that show. And the more you liked it and the more you remember it, the better the movie will be. As Rolling Stone said in their profanity-laden headline of their review, a fucking fitting conclusion to television's true unfinished masterpiece.
Ah, I didn't realize they didn't close Deadwood, the TV series.
No, it got canceled rather than concluded.
No. Well, then there you go.
And so coming back for it, a reunion of all the major cast brought together in this town in the, Black Hills of Dakota for the event of Dakota becoming statehood, gaining statehood.
Ah.
And at that point, the show's villain, George Hurst, had, of course, become the junior senator from the state of California. And he returns. So it's so good. And everything in a way that I wanted the Highwaymen to be.
Ah, oh, damn it. Okay, well, this is fascinating because I only saw a handful of Deadwood episodes. And I'm hoping now that they will lay them out so I can binge watch them all in a hurry to get to the movie.
It's really worth it. Director Daniel Minahan, from a script by David Milch, of course, most famous for creating NYPD Blue. But they're back. The cast is back. But it is not, as I said, it's the movie that I wanted the Highwaymen to be. It's not a big screen movie, Deadwood movie. It is a TV movie, and it does work best as that. It would lose something theatrically. Netflix made The Highwaymen with the idea of, okay, this is going to be a big screen movie for the smaller screen, right? For the streaming service. And that's exactly what they always end up getting wrong, and why last year's Ballad of Buster Scruggs and, of course, the Orson Welles movie and Alfonso Cuarón, why these were such outliers and seemed to be harbingers of even more dominance for Netflix to come. Well, hold your horses. maybe it is if they can keep signing deals with the greatest current auteurs, the Coen brothers, the Alfonso Cuarons, and unfinished products from the greatest auteurs of all time, like Orson Welles. If they're doing that, then yes. Roma and The Other Side of the Wind and Ballad of Buster Scruggs might have been harbingers of even bigger things to come. But if they don't, they're not positioned to do what an HBO does. HBO really understands the direction of how to make programming that will please a continuing audience. I mean, isn't it amazing that HBO still continues and still has the cultural footprint that it does after so many decades?
So many decades. You think of when Home Box Office first started. I think it's where I first saw Robin Williams in a live comedy show, or one of his hour-long specials. They were doing comedy specials. They were doing real breakthrough stuff. Even the Larry Sanders Show. How great was that? And that still holds up. And so, yeah, HBO has been around, and you got to think they've gone through generations of executives, but still the culture is permeating through and through. So
we'll close here, but unless seriously the economics are shift in significant ways, and they will. There's no doubt they will. I mean, technology is constantly upsetting the apple cart. Unless it is shifted in major ways, I almost feel like we are going to still be doing this show. And in a handful of years, we're going to be looking at four companies that are really meaningful and nothing else. You'll be talking, we're really there, actually. I guess five Amazon. I was thinking Netflix, HBO, Disney,
Right.
And I guess Amazon's the other company. And then the Amazon. Outlier is, will going to the movies be meaningful?
Right.
But theaters, Netflix, HBO, and Disney.
Those are the big, the big ones.
Yeah.
Wow. I know. Isn't that wild?
So, all right. Okay. That's a bonus, an extra long episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, especially important because we won't be doing a new show next week. We have something, a wonderful interview show. Maybe I'll hook up with you for a few minutes so I can get a report on Chicago.
Yes.
But otherwise, a special pre-recorded episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour next week. And that's it. We're at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, hollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
Absolutely. And write us, like Bob Petrulis did, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
So easy. And till next week, I'm Dean Haglin.
You don't want people to like us?
Oh, not anymore.
Not since you learned about the Canadian genocide. All right.
Yes.
I'm Phil Lernis. Until next week when we code talk to you again.
Yay. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.